Hello, this is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. Today is the last day of July, July the 31st, 2020. And I am very pleased today to continue my discussion with Professor Ronan McCrae. You may recall that we did our first podcast on July the 20th, and that was an incredibly interesting discussion, which illuminated the fact that there are many countries, specifically Ireland, we used the example, who have all kinds of citizens or people with claims to citizenship that don't even live in Ireland. And this is true of a number of other countries. Canada, interestingly, it's also true of the United States. So what we have in a large number of countries worldwide is a situation where there are many citizens abroad. And on the one hand, it's pretty clear that they have very few obligations of citizenship, very, very few. Perhaps some countries have more than others, but they appear to have all the rights of citizenship. And so where that leaves us is a situation where we have an awful lot of citizens who have the rights, but not the obligations. And today we're going to pick up sort of from that point and talk a little bit about the obligations or the possible obligations of citizens in a democracy, why those obligations are important, and why those obligations sort of need to be reinforced to essentially save democracy from its worst tendencies. So thank you, Ronan, for joining me again. I see that you remain in Ireland as we speak.
That's right.
That's great. I wish I were in Ireland. I've always loved Ireland, and I hate the Toronto weather, so you're lucky.
It's raining actually, here. Yes.
That's okay. I like the rain. We're not getting a lot of rain in Toronto. Okay. So generally speaking, and then moving on to some specifics, would you agree as a general principle that we have kind of moved into an era where citizenship focuses on rights of citizenship and not so much on the obligations of citizenship? I mean, we're even moving into a world where more and more countries are willing to sell citizenship. So that seems to be the trend, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, our discussion, we do, I mean, especially lawyers as well, because most of the cases that go to court are about the rights of citizenship. But also politically, I mean, there were, I suppose, in the past, a lot of countries, things like military service, where, and that's kind of faded away. But just more generally, yeah, the idea that citizenship is not just about rights, but is about obligations, probably has less, it doesn't have a very strong prominence. And one of the things that the reasons that is so difficult, poses so many difficulties, is that if you think is in democracy is based on the idea of citizens exercising collective self-government through elections. And I always notice, everyone says very often, politicians lie, and there was you always hear on the kind of TV shows or radio shows, the politicians have lied, and the electorate is angry, and they're waiting for them in the grass. They're going to get them into the next election. And it always, whenever I hear that, it strikes me as strange, because I always think, if you think of an angry voter, they say, "God, were you lied to? God, you were lying, and who and or your government has done terrible things. Well, you must be very mad at and angry at the people who've the government, the people who selected that government." But the people who select the government are the voters, and they say, "Ah, the voters were lied to." And you think, "Well, why are voters lied? Why do politicians lie?" And you think, "Well, politicians respond to incentives, and politicians lie because voters won't vote for politicians who tell the truth." And so, because if you think most Western countries, we're living way beyond our means in terms of the climate. We're living way beyond our means in terms of pensions. We've got unsustainable pension arrangements with our population structures. But politicians won't level with voters about that. They're not going to say, "We're going to have to reduce our lifestyle," because the next politician will come along and say, "Oh, it's not true, it's not true. They're going to cut, they're going to raise the pension age, cut the pension, vote for me and I won't do that." A lot of voters respond to that. Unless voters take their responsibilities as voters, not to just vote for the person who says, "I'm going to give you more," or but to actually really examine the candidates, vote not just in their personal interest, but in the interest of society as a whole, democracy isn't can't really work. And you, that has been, for centuries, the worry about people who've looked at theorists of history of democracy. The ancient Greeks worried about that. De Tocqueville, famous French writer, a couple of centuries ago about the US, worried about that. That the democracies have a tendency to vary towards short-termism and towards not focusing on the big issues and focusing on kind of the soap opera of politics instead. And I think behind that, in currently, is the idea of citizens as consumers and voters as consumers, that politicians need to do whatever the voters want. The customer is always right. And I think that attitude is incompatible with the sustainability of democracy. Unless voters are self-critical, unless voters take their obligations as voters very seriously, unless they vote in the collective interest, then the system is going to end up, as it currently is, just kind of engaging in very short-term policies that are in long-run unsustainable.
Well, so, you know, linking that to the whole notion of citizenship, so you say, and I mean, I do agree with you that an obligation of citizenship is to be engaged. And I think that an obligation of citizenship probably should be to think long term. And most importantly, to realize that there are issues in a democracy that transcend the wants or desires of any one individual. So, you know, one would think that even if you wanted, for example, a bylaw, you know, allowing a dog to run up and down your street personally, you know, there's a difference between that and recognizing that it's in the common good for that to not take place. And so a fundamental attribute of a functioning democracy and responsible citizenship would be to recognize that there is a whole that's greater than the individual parts. Is that, do I kind of have that right?
Yes, and also that there's a kind of distinction between you as a citizen and you yourself. So often there's a real clash of perspectives, I think, between left liberals and left-wingers in North America and often the English-speaking world, and say the French tradition. So in the French tradition, citizenship is considered fundamental. And the idea is actually that we are all citizens and the citizenship is something we share, but you as a citizen is kind of separate from you as a person who's a any particular racial or religious or sexual or identity, that you as a citizen in the public square are kind of, you're not conscious, you set aside your particularities and you all act as citizens.
So in other words, you've got a job to do. You have a responsibility, for instance, like, you have a job.
And in France, civil servants are not permitted to wear religious symbols. And you see it in Quebec, in France, in Canada as well. They follow the French tradition to some degree. The idea is, if I'm a civil servant, that's separate from me as an individual. And I must appear kind of stripped of my particularities. So, and like in France as well, in France, they will not count. We don't know what the kind of ethnic racial breakdown of the French population is from the French census, because the French state will not collect statistics on racial origin, because they say it's irrelevant to the Republic. You're all just citizens. Now, a lot of people criticize that because they say, well, there's a lot of hidden prejudices within that, that what they assume is neutral is not really neutral and stuff. But in general, the idea, and that's in France, that's seen as a left-wing thing. So you often, there's a lot of discussion in academic law and things about, for instance, rules in France that say you can't wear religious symbols in, if you're a civil servant or in a state school. And when I read particularly, when I read North American critiques of that, they assume that's like a Jim Crow law. This is a kind of no Muslim law. Whereas actually in France, it's seen as quite a left-wing position. They're saying, no, absolutely, the schools and the state need to be religiously neutral. Nobody can bring their religion into the school. They see that as left-wing, whereas in America, through American or North American eyes, that's seen as a kind of crazy right-wing position. And often there's just a complete failure, lack of kind of overlap, of mutual misunderstanding about each side. But in France, I think because citizenship is so important.
Does that differentiation, this is a thought that popped into my head, I have no idea what the answer might be, but does that follow from the civil law tradition versus the common law tradition in any way?
I mean, I think it mainly flows in France from the French Revolution and the idea of citizenship as central, that the citizens of the Republic are, it's all about. So, for instance, like France gave equality to Jews in France around the time of the Revolution, and the famous statement of the French National Assembly, I think by a Jewish politician, or at least by a pro-equality politician, said, we must give the Jews everything as individuals and nothing as a community. So the idea is that everyone individually is equal as a citizen. That the flip side of that is we do not give particular communities extra rights. So we don't give, I mean, it was a reaction against partly that nobles had all these extra rights or exempt from taxation, or Catholics had more rights than Jews and like that. And the French tradition was about individual equality. Everyone must be treated individually equally as a citizen. But then that leans against what they see as communitarism, which is kind of group rights. Now, in the US, the UK, and Canada, a lot of them, left-wing thought has come to embrace some kind of ideas of group rights, partly to kind of affirmative action and things like that, to redress historic injustices. But in France, that's seen as undermining the project of having, and it's also heavily debated in France, but in France, the predominant view is that undermines the tradition of treating everybody equally as an individual.
You know, that's a very interesting point you make. You know, as you may know, Canadian Charter of Rights is relatively new, 1982. And off the top of my head, I can think of at least two sections of the Charter of Rights that guarantee group rights, right? Or at the very least, recognize group rights, if not elevating them to a constitutional right, elevating them to a right of acknowledgement in interpreting constitutional rights, which is quite interesting. And, it seems to me that the 14th Amendment, the equal protection jurisprudence in the United States, has also been interpreted, I think, to include group rights as well. Fascinating stuff. Now, so clearly, citizens have got to have responsibilities, and I think that you're noting the difference between the individual as an individual and the individual as a citizen. I think that's a very, very useful distinction. Last time we talked about this whole idea of all these citizens abroad. Now, should citizens abroad for these countries, what kind of responsibilities should they have? Are they the same, or does the fact they live abroad make a difference? Or what are your thoughts on that?
So, yeah, there's rights and responsibilities. Now, one thing I think is probably correct is that citizens abroad should lose their right to vote in national elections pretty quickly, because America, no taxation without representation. But then the flip side of that is no representation without taxation. If you're not living in a country, you're not paying the taxes, you won't actually be fully affected by the citizen, by the kind of political decisions taken. Why are you voting? So I think that should be pretty limited. I think there are some instances, like you could have, like in Ireland, like in Canada, the Senate is not that powerful and is not directly elected. So you could have a thing where, Irish people abroad have a couple of seats in the Senate or something. But I don't think, if you're not living in a country and you're not going to be affected fully by the political decisions, you shouldn't be able to vote. The US, I think, has a good compromise where if you're American, you're living abroad, you are liable for US taxes. Now, you can set off rightly the taxes you're paying in the other country. But if they're super low, your American citizenship follows you around the world. And I think that's right, because you're saying, I'm a US citizen, something goes wrong, I want to call the US embassy, I want to, this is where it is. Well, that shouldn't be for free. And I think one of the things I think is really important for the sustainability of democracy is that we treat citizenship seriously. We take it as something that's very valuable. It's the center of our life together and our loyalty to each other. And that means, I think, if you're an American citizen, you think, I only want to be an American citizen if it doesn't cost me anything. Then I think they're entitled to say, sorry, then it's not for you. So I think it's really good that America basically follows its citizens around the world and makes sure they pay a minimum level of tax. Ireland and most European countries do not do that. They just give you the pass, the citizenship, or allow you to retain it. And if you're outside the country, you don't pay anything. And I think that to me just doesn't treat serious citizenship seriously enough. There's also issues in the same vein about dual nationality. So I have no criticism of anyone who has dual nationality, because I think if you're allowed, good for you, take it up. But I can see why some countries don't allow it, because the idea of citizenship is like polygamy. You know, you can only be married to one person, and because if you try to be married to two people, you can't be sufficiently committed to either spouse. And I think if we treat citizenship really important, really seriously, countries are entitled to say, well, hang on, is your primary loyalty to us or to some other country? And I think a lot of people see that as are very uncomfortable with that, but I think that's fine, actually. I think countries are entitled to say, we only want you to be a citizen if you're loyal, if your primary loyalty is to us. So in the same way, I'm against polygamy, and I think it's reasonable for states not to allow dual citizenship, just because I think it's incompatible with the, could be seen as incompatible with the loyalty needed. Now that's, I want to stress that I'm not criticizing any people who have dual nationality. I think it's fine if you're allowed. I would take it up always take up myself if I had any passport I'm entitled to for convenience. I can see why a country would not say that's okay. That citizenship is about loyalty, and if you're a citizen somewhere else, then you're not giving your primary loyalty to the state.
Well, it's interesting that going back to all these Irish Americans, so they naturalize as American citizens, and I realize this doesn't have legal significance, but I mean, as part of the whole citizenship acquisition, the ceremony in that, I believe they are required to say they are renouncing other citizenships. Should Ireland take them at their word?
Yeah, they don't, because Ireland permits people to have dual citizenship, and America, I think Ireland has a kind of exceptional arrangement along with a couple of other countries. That allows Irish people naturalizing Americans to retain their citizenship. I think Israel and Italy are allowed too. I don't know if it's beginning with I or what the rule is. I'm not sure exactly what the rule is, but I know that Irish people becoming American citizens are not required to renounce. And they're not treated as having renounced their citizenship by Ireland.
Are you aware of any countries they might become citizens of where they'd be treated as renouncing Irish citizenship?
No, I think Ireland is totally relaxed about dual nationality. Indeed, totally relaxed about citizenship, as we discussed last time.
It's a potential time bomb waiting to explode. You know, particularly countries like Ireland, like Canada, and interestingly, like the United States, where anybody born outside the United States to American citizen parents is basically an American citizen. So, who knows? Who knows how many people there are out there. And one of the things that I find very interesting looking at this in the American political context is in the immigration debate, all this discussion that we have to keep Group A out of the United States, we have to keep Group B, this sort of stuff. But, the citizenship laws are actually creating in a lot of these countries that the U.S. government finds offensive, large numbers of American citizens with no connection to the United States whatsoever, with an absolute right to enter the United States and live there. I mean, if you were an American government policymaker, would you see that as a problem?
I mean, it depends on the note, because the U.S. has traditionally been a country of immigration rather than emigration, and is quite a big country. It probably isn't going to be a huge issue. But for small countries that have historically been countries of emigration, I think it could be an issue. Also, just I think the world is so unpredictable. I mean, America's building a wall to keep out, on the southern border. But, the way the coronavirus is going, Canada's almost building a wall to keep them out coming north. So who'd have predicted that?
I wouldn't say a wall, but there's not a lot of enthusiasm for American tourism this summer.
In Ireland, too, we've seen a lot of people are very concerned about planes landing from Dallas. Or I notice people, if you see in Ireland a British registration plate, people are looking, kind of going, oh, God, where are they coming from? Have they been through their quarantine? People do get quite tense about it.
Well, what is the rule of the present time? I checked a few weeks ago for Ireland, and I think the rule is that there's a 14-day quarantine, isn't it, if you enter Ireland? Yeah, well, that's pretty significant. What do? You check into one of the expensive hotels near Dublin Airport?
Follow-up is quite poor, because when I came from London, I quarantined in an Airbnb for 2 weeks, and I didn't get a call to check where I was, but... there have been an incident was last week or the week before where there was a group from Texas in a restaurant and asked for a table in Kerry, and the owner said, have you been through your quarantine? They said no, and he turned them away. The requirement is that you quarantine for 14 days when you come into Ireland, which given how much annual leave from work Americans have means that
there's no tourism. There couldn't possibly
you couldn't come to tourism. Yeah. Or at least you wouldn't come as a tourist and respect the quarantine.
That is correct. That is correct. Yeah.
And it's the same in Canada, I presume, that there's a quarantine if you come or
let's say if I were to go to Ireland, I wanted to get on the plane and go to Ireland, nobody would stop me. I would have a 14-day quarantine in Ireland, and coming back to Canada, I would have a 14-day quarantine. So for me to fly to Ireland or, presumably the UK or, whatever, anywhere, it makes it impossible. It's interesting because, people are essentially locked into their borders at the present time. Now, I don't mind being in Canada. It's a big enough place so I can, always feel like I'm going somewhere new. But, this is a new world.
There is a list. It's called the Green List here. There's a certain number of European countries you're allowed to go to that have lower virus levels than Ireland that you don't have to quarantine when you come back from. But it's only within Europe and all other. So high virus countries like Spain and the UK are not on that. And then from outside Europe, you have to quarantine. Which even if your virus levels are lower than Ireland, they have to quarantine for 14 days.
You mentioned a couple minutes ago that you thought that assuming citizenship carries the right to vote, the taxation of citizens abroad would be appropriate. Would you advocate for the taxation of Irish citizens in the United States? Ireland.
I mean, if they want to be able to use Irish consulate, Irish facilities, have passports, I think so. Yeah, I think I think they should be. There should be obviously mutual recognition, setting off any taxes they pay.
The tax credit rules and that sort of stuff.
It may not the full level whack of taxation because income is taxed pretty heavily in Ireland. I think it goes up to 55% quite quickly.
Sounds like Canada.
I would think if the Irish authorities said, well, we want, if you want to be a citizen, we want 1% of your income per year. I don't see a problem with that. I think that's fair enough because, why should I, as an Irish person living outside Ireland, be able to use the facilities, the diplomatic facilities, if I need them without ever contributing? If I want to be regarded as a full citizen of Ireland, then I think they're entitled to say, well, show us some loyalty here. Yeah, there's some reciprocity.
What about a situation where, let's imagine that the government of Ireland said, well, we agree with Professor McCrae. We think that citizenship-based taxation is appropriate. What if they said, but you know, a lot of people outside of Ireland who have better opportunities than they maybe do in Ireland. Why don't we tax them more heavily than if they lived in Ireland? What would be your thinking on that?
I mean, they could definitely, well, they could. I imagine that would probably produce, that's there'd be definitely a legal challenge on, would that be a breach of equality to tax people more heavily on the basis of being outside the state. So A, it could be counterproductive if people abandon citizenship. B, it might be unconstitutional because it'd be kind of unfair. There would also be a further unfairness in that if those people don't have full voting rights, as they currently don't in Ireland, it'd be kind of unfair to be penally taxing them. So I think that would be, but the issue is if you're an Irish person living outside Ireland, under the statelessness convention, they couldn't make you stateless, but you could, I'm thinking of people who are dual nationals who have the option to renounce Irish citizenship if they don't.
And don't.
Yeah. But I think, I think if they started heavily taxing foreign resident Irish people without kind of any justification other than, well, we can, that would be a little unfair.
And to confirm, you think it would be unfair if the tax obligations were far in excess of what somebody living in Ireland would experience?
Well, especially because you wouldn't be using the health service or the education service, and you'd be paying for equivalent services in the country of your residence. So I think that would be a little unfair.
Well, okay. So, you know, it's interesting to me when you were describing it earlier, you said, well, maybe a 1% tax or something. So, I mean, you didn't sound like you were committing necessarily to the same kind of taxation.
No.
Well, what would you think about saying, to keep it administratively simple? It's one of the problems with tax. It's not so much the tax, but the compliance issue, right? You know, how hard is it to comply? What about something like, pay X dollars a year to keep your Irish passport current or something like that?
Well,
would that
I wouldn't
be
want
an administrative proxy?
The only worry would be, I think a flat fee would be a bit unfair because then it's much more of a burden on the poor than the very wealthy. So it'd be nicer if it was a percentage of your income. But then
a percentage.
But then working out what your percentage of your income is, and of course, you often find that the super wealthy arrange it so that their taxable income is nothing, even though they're millionaires. So there'd be all kinds of compliance.
Although that's why they're millionaires, Ron. It's because they arrange for their taxable income to be nothing. Yeah. Very, very interesting. Well, given the, going back to our first discussion about the impact of the COVID-19 situation, which, is sure to have an impact on most everything in the world, I think including the notion of citizenship. Do you think it's likely that there will be more of an internal discussion in these countries? I mean, what does citizenship really mean? What are we requiring of our citizens? Or do you think it's going to be just restricted to podcasts like this?
Well, I think across all policy areas, people are going to probably become a little more risk averse or awareness of how uncertain things are. I was listening to a podcast about the history of tennis recently, and they were discussing how Martina Navratilova, who had defected from the Czech Republic, and how her parents couldn't watch her play Wimbledon because they were in the Czech Republic, in Czechoslovakia, in communist Czechoslovakia. And one of the commentators said, yes, and we'll never have that again. That kind of thing is sad. There was that awful situation again. Another commentator, and these are just tennis people, they're not like particularly interested in anything beyond tennis, but they said, well, I think after this year, we don't say never about anything. And I thought that was kind of interesting example of how just in general, this is, nobody thought this time last year, we didn't conceive that everyone be wearing masks, confined to your home, sports events canceled, everything canceled. No one, this wasn't on anyone's radar. And I think the fact that our life can be upended so suddenly and so quickly means that across the board, people are going to get more cautious. And that may apply to citizenship, particularly as borders now are seen as, and closed borders are increasingly popular. I suspect across the board, people may just start looking in general and start thinking, yeah, do we, in the Irish case, where we, as we've written this check, where we've now have many times the resident population are entitled to citizenship, then people might start thinking, I wonder if that is a good idea. Now, I think because Ireland is very economically linked to the US and has, you know, as a sentimental link because of the history of immigration and things, it would take a while, but definitely I think that is it's something that may be reviewed. Plus, you know, after Brexit, Ireland's future is now ever more closely tied to the European Union, and one of the interesting things is how the European Union now exercise indirect control over citizenship laws. So they say, in general, citizenship, grant of citizenship is a matter for member states, but because it brings with it EU citizenship, they must exercise that power in a way that respects the fundamental rules of EU law. So Cyprus and Malta and have come in trouble for selling citizenship. And the European Commission...
I'd be very interested to have you expand on that a little bit. I mean, I'm very interested in the whole, what most people call citizenship by investment. I think it is more of citizenship as investment, in an increasingly unpredictable world. So how do you think we start from the principle that if Ireland is part of the EU, as a general principle, Irish citizenship laws are an internal matter, but they must respect the basic EU principles. And now, you started this. And I'd like to get your thoughts in a more expansive way on this. How does the reality and the growth of these citizenship by investment programs interact with those key principles?
So the European Commission has taken the view that citizenship cannot be purely financial. You can't just buy it. Now, but there are, I mean, I think Malta had a scheme where you didn't even have to buy it. You invest a certain amount of money in the country and
there's a number of those out there. Yeah. There are a number of them.
And there was an issue because they're worried about kind of money laundering, about people with ill-gotten gains becoming citizens. And they're at least, I'd need to look up more on this, but they were threatening to take Malta to court. And I think Malta, to avoid the court case, made kind of tweaks to the to their program. They also, because the main way EU laws come involved is normally in terms of deprivation of nationality. So there have been cases where, there's a case actually I worked on when I clerked in the court, a German who became an Austrian citizen, and they don't tolerate dual nationality, so to renounce his German citizenship, but then wasn't fully honest with the Austrians about his criminal past. Therefore, having renounced his German citizenship, he then lost his Austrian citizenship because he hadn't been frank in his application. And he said, "You're because I lose both my Austrian citizenship, I now lose my EU citizenship." And the court said, again, they said, well, in general, it's for national authorities to decide, but the decision needs to be proportionate. And we'll leave it to the national courts to decide if this dishonesty was sufficient grounds to justify depriving the citizenship. So the control is fairly light touch and it's indirect. There have been also cases now, which haven't worked so far, about British citizens saying, I was an EU citizen when Britain was part of the EU, and now I'm losing it because of Brexit, and it's not fair of you to deprive me of my European citizenship. That's so far that has failed. But the main issue is that the EU will retain because the principle of any EU power over a national grant of citizenship has been controversial. The degree of control exercise has been pretty light, but now that could change over time. And as kind of there's a lot of clamping down in general on white collar crime, on corporate taxation arrangements that are unduly favorable to the super wealthy or to corporations. So I wonder, there's a lot of concern about Russia in Britain, about Russian influence of kind of oligarchs and stuff. So you wonder if those citizenship schemes may come under increasing scrutiny by either the EU or other bodies in the near future.
Well, you know, they have come under scrutiny by the OECD for tax reasons. You know, it's quite interesting because there's, you know, obviously there's huge growth in that. And the more unstable the world gets, the more I see dual, personally, this is my personal view, the more I see dual citizenship as, you know, a valuable investment, you know, like a piece of real estate or, you know, or anything else. And, you know, to bring us back to, you know, the discussion we've been having, which, you know, is in part, you know, what exactly should be the connection, the commitment to a country in order to get citizenship? And you wonder, you know, if you can just write a check and buy it. I mean, you know, is that sufficient or not? I mean, I understand that's going on. I understand that, you know, you buy the citizenship, you're a citizen of the country. But I guess my question to you would be, although in general, the international law appears to be that every country has the right to decide who its citizens are, is it the case that every other country has the obligation to respect that decision once it's been made?
Yeah, and one thing that's, you know, I think in the 1990s where we thought we're all getting over nationalism, we're all getting over these tribal identities, we're kind of realizing now we're much, much less rational creatures than we think we are humans. And we are very attached to these kind of non-rational tribal identities. And in fact, that's the source of much of the strength of our society, that we feel a bond to our fellow citizens. You know, why did anyone ever fight in a war to save their country? It's a, you know, on an individual level, it's a crazy idea to go head off the front lines and potentially get shot to save the collective entity. But we have an emotional commitment to it. In the same way, we have emotional commitments to your family or your children. That, I mean, you know, even if people have children and the children are nasty, they still love their children. And that's the strength of families, is that people look after their kids, even if their kids are not nice people. And the same with countries. We have an irrational, I'm not saying it's, sorry, a non-rational, not irrational. We have a non-rational bond with all these strangers in our country who we've never met. So, you know, someone in Newfoundland feels some connection to someone in Vancouver who is thousands of kilometers away and who they've never met, but they feel a sense of collective purpose. And without that collective purpose, governments and modern societies don't really function. Because why are we sacrificing our income to pay welfare for other people? Why are we sustaining these collective institutions? Well, because we feel connected to the idea of our country. And an approach towards citizenship that says anyone can come in, anyone can buy it, or anyone can get it, doesn't matter, is not really compatible with the strength of the bond needed to sustain those institutions. So the worldview that suggested that we would all just become kind of citizens of humanity is attractive in one way, it's very egalitarian. But if you imagine a world in which we decided not to treat citizenship or nation state citizenship as important at all, it would be a world where we had the same level of duties towards everybody. But that would mean that those duties were not very extensive. So currently, say in Western Europe, citizenship involves saying, we're in the same country, we share institutions. If you get sick, I'll pay for you. If you lose your job, I'll pay for you. Very high levels of mutual duties. If you have a world where you say, you know what, we're all just citizens of the world, you won't have intense duties to pay for the unemployed, to look after the sick, because you couldn't possibly. I mean, Britain, the most popular institution in Britain is their health service, called the National Health Service. And I think that first word is key, NHS, National Health Service. British people, British citizens are saying, we will look after each other if we get sick. If it became not the NHS, but the WHS, the World Health Service, the level of service it would be able to provide would be very basic indeed. There wouldn't be kind of cancer surgeries or major operations. Britain could only afford to give very minimal level of healthcare to everybody. So citizenship is to some degree exclusive, exclusionary. We can only have an intense version of citizenship and have democratic institutions, welfare state, and things like that, if citizenship is taken seriously and if it has boundaries.
Yeah, so, or to put it perhaps another way, the only way to get real benefits from citizenship is to make real contributions to the citizenship.
Yeah, it's based on a tight mutuality. I give a lot, and I can then take a lot.
So this would mean that a lot of these citizens abroad, I mean, regardless of countries, and, in a very real sense, are freeloaders.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't do, because I don't think they're doing anything wrong, because the rules permit them to have the citizenship.
I don't mean it in a pejorative sense.
But they are also, it is to some degree freeloading, or potentially freeloading. If you are, and a lot of, like for the NHS, if you can just turn up with a British passport, never having lived there, like when you get sick and say, take care of me, that's definitely freeloading. and it is even harsher when we have a situation in the UK where non-European migrants have to pay a health fee every year to use the National Health Service, because they don't want to avoid kind of freeloading. So it would seem a bit, if you are overly generous and allow too many people to become British citizens without any real connection, they can just turn up and then use the NHS. That's probably, there's a degree of unfairness when people who've been living a lot of their lives in the UK have to pay.
Well, I think that there's clear unfairness. I mean, that's a pretty easy situation to see, because there's just no contribution whatsoever. Well, this is, this has been, like the first one, incredibly interesting and thought-provoking. I think we probably should continue this into a podcast 3 at some point down the road. But I think what I'm getting from this is that citizenship matters. You better take it seriously. And you're going to have to give something to be a member of that community.
As with all important institutions, it has pluses and minuses. Citizenship matters. It's the basis of most of our collective institutions. But that also means that we have to take it seriously and place some boundaries on it. The kind of, what are the boundaries? I don't think the boundaries should be just about blood. I think it should be a more or less racially tinged forms of connection. But those need to be real forms of connection. And so look, as with everything, there's kind of pluses and minuses. But yeah, it's been a really interesting discussion.
One more question, and maybe we can pick up on this one on a future podcast. But we've talked a lot about the connection between being a citizen and democratic values and democracy. I believe Australia requires its citizens to vote. Canada certainly doesn't. What would be your thoughts on that? Should citizens be required to vote?
Yeah, I don't see anything wrong with it. You can, if you really want, you can scribble on your ballot paper and spoil it. But to say that we want you to participate, Belgium does the same. I don't think it, it doesn't seem to change political outcomes that much. Whereas, because some people have said, well, compulsory voting will make it, make politicians more attentive to the needs of the poor, because the poor tend not to vote. I don't see much evidence of that. But I, in principle, I don't mind certain minimal obligations being placed on people in that way.
Very interesting. Okay, well, thanks again for joining me.
Thank
today.
You.
I've got to tell you, these are incredibly thought-provoking conversations.
It was enjoyable.
Yeah, and hopefully we can pick this up again, and I will get this podcast up in the next few days. Thanks very much. I'm speaking with Rona McRae. This is podcast number 2, and I think we'll probably have another one as we sort of rewrite the world order here. Okay, thanks very much, Rona.
Thanks very much, John. Talk to you again. Bye.